This is Regina Kong with the Hobbit Hole Oral History Project. Today I'm with Bob O'Bell on July 23rd, 2019 at his home in Elephant Cove. Could we begin just by having you restate your name? And I don't know if you want to start with your life or the Hobbit Hole.
I don't know. Bob O'Bell is my name. And I don't know. You asked me the questions and I'll...
Why don't we start? Just tell me a little bit about where you were born.
All right. I was born in Indiana and went through high school and got out of there as quick as I could. And I went to college for 5 years at Michigan State. And then I got a pickup truck and I headed for Alaska searching for adventure. And I found more than I could ever asked for.
What was your first impression of Alaska?
First impression of Alaska. Well, let's see. Oh, we drove to Prince Rupert and ended up getting off the ferry and took the ferry to Juneau and then on up to Haines and drove up to the interior. But I guess my first impression was hanging out in Juneau by Mendenhall Glacier Lake and in the rain, and it's pretty cool. And then when we drove through from Haines Junction to Beaver Creek, we crossed Beaver Creek into Alaska proper, and there was a double rainbow, and it was like, yeah, this feels like home. That was my first impression.
And were you fishing at that time?
No. Fishing came later. Yeah. I had no intention of being a fisherman. I came up to do kayaking. I ran a bunch of rivers every summer for, I don't know, probably half a dozen years. And then I bought a fishing boat in Fairbanks, which is 600 miles from the ocean, so and that's a whole nother story.
What made you want to buy a fishing boat?
Well, one of those kayak adventures, I was in Prince William Sound and we were in Cordova and there were a couple young guys going out halibut fishing and asked if I wanted to jump on board, and I thought, yeah, that sounds like fun. So I jumped on board and they were neophytes. They didn't really know what they were doing. We didn't catch hardly any halibut at all, but it sort of perked my interest. And then actually later that year I was talking to a guy who also had an interest in fishing and was a good friend of Greg Howe's at the Hobbit Hole, and he had just seen this little 26 foot bartender in Fairbanks, and we went over and we bought it about a week later and towed it down to Haines. Greg met us in Juneau. That was when the ferry used to come into Juneau at 3 a.m. to haul this boat off the trailer, off the ferry. So that was my introduction to Greg and the Hobbit Hole, 3 a.m. in the morning. That's a pretty good friend to come and do that. He borrowed a truck to haul that trailer off. So.
And then your first time going to the Hobbit Hole, do you remember what that was like?
Yeah, just coming through that gut and seeing it, you know, it's a pretty special place. So, you know, but it was all so new at the time, you know, the boat, the fishing, everything, you know. So it was, the world was our oyster. So,
what was difficult, or what challenges did you face when you first started fishing?
Okay, I didn't know squat. And turns out Pat Fisher, who I bought the boat with, he was an expert because he had fished the coast of California for a week, maybe, trolling. And he didn't know squat either. So it was a very big learning curve. And that first season was... looking back on it, pretty hilarious. But, you know, I thought it was pretty cool that you could make money fishing. So, and it obviously has worked out for us.
And then how did you get involved with the Hobbit Hole?
Well, like I said, Patrick was a good friend of Greg's up in Fairbanks. And Greg and Fred had both lived, gone to school up in Fairbanks for a while. And so that's how I got involved, you know. And then once I got there, it was like, yeah, this place is happening, you know. And Greg welcomed us with open arms. So that's how I got involved with the Hobbit Hole.
And when you got there, Deborah was already there?
Yeah, Deborah had her own little fishing boat, and she'd been there for a couple of years, actually. So that was 78 I showed up, I think.
Do you remember when you met her for the first time?
Do I remember the first time I met her? Yeah, maybe in Juneau. She was in there and running around, and I don't know.
We were doing Fred's boat.
You were working
on... He was on the grid.
Yeah, but you needed to deliver something to Patty's house. And I had a car. Can't imagine I had a car. Yeah. But anyway, I took Deborah somewhere to deliver something, you know. That was the first time I met her.
Oh.
I was in Juneau. On the way to the Hobbit Hole, I guess.
Tea?
Yes, please. Thank you. And I heard you have a story about the talent show.
The talent show? Well, yeah. I suppose the story with the talent show is that the way I got involved with fishing, I ran a medicine show in Fairbanks. And I could cure Dr. Ogstad's traveling medicine show. I could cure anything. And it was a crazy, wild bunch of people and music and clowns and juggling. And Patrick, that I bought the boat with, he was a puppeteer. And he came and he had seen the show. And he said, hey, are you interested in having puppets in your show? You know, and I said, we're interested in anything, you know. So he joined the troupe, and that's when we started talking about fishing, you know. And like I say, I met him one day, and a week later, we'd bought a boat together. So that's the talent show sort of runs from that, those medicine show days. Mm-hmm.
So what did you do for the Hobbit Hole talent shows?
What's that?
So what did you do for the Hobbit Hole talent shows?
The Hobbit Hole talent show. I can remember one talent show, and a friend, Kate Bull, was here, and I'm a banjo player, and she's a banjo player, so we did a two-headed banjo player with one banjo, and one of us did the neck, and the other one did the frailing, you know, so... And then actually, Culture was talking about there's some films over there of it, you know, and I don't remember, but there's some game where Dennis and I were racing to see who could peel and eat the carrots the most or fastest or something. But I have no recollection of that, but it's on film, so. Yeah.
Besides talent shows, were there other celebrations or parties that you really enjoyed?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were always parties at the Hobbit Hole, you know. The 4th of July celebration was always the biggest. Now, you would never go there on the 4th of July because it's when we get to fish king salmon. But back then, everybody would take the day or two off. And we had a cannon that Joe Craig, who was here, this was his place, that he built when he was in high school. And so you'd fire that cannon off, and it was, I remember coming in the 4th of July celebration, and the lawn's just full of people, and I'm exhausted because I've been fishing really hard. And I was, at that time I had that bartender, and I was kind of standing on the back deck, and that cannon went off, and I just about jumped into the water. It's startling. But yeah, the parties at the Hobbit Hole were were legendary. They were really good. And it was pretty much always a party, you know. Mm. I mean, once we got a cook and a gardener, you know, we'd all come in at 7 at night for dinner, you know, and just relive the day, tell our tales, and, you know. So, I guess that's not a party, but it was a great atmosphere, you know. We were all growing up together and learning together and sharing fishing tips and life tips, and, you know, pretty amazing place.
Are there any stories from the Hobbit Hole that really stand out to you?
Any stories? Nothing's coming to mind right now. I mean, like I say, it was pretty much every day something new and different, you know. Most of
the flood in the warehouse.
Yeah, there was one flood one day. It rained 3 inches in an hour, and it the creek rocks came down and blocked the underside of the warehouse, and all that water was diverted right through the warehouse. So there was a foot of water pouring out the front door of the warehouse, and everything in the warehouse just floating, and it was quite a mess. And you know, we had kept the calendars every day. And
what were the calendars?
Mm-hmm. Every day, and usually it was Ronald, but if Ronald wasn't around, somebody else would fill it out, and it'd just be, there'd be drawings and stories, day-to-day stories, you know. And I think Greg and Jane must still have the calendars. They're pretty cool. And kind of, we knew that what was going on there was special enough that it should be, you know, recorded. So the calendars were pretty cool.
What do you think was one of the most special parts of being at the Hobbit Hole for you?
Meeting Deborah. Just the freedom that we had, you know. It was the camaraderie, you know. It was a pretty fun group of people. And, you know, one of the cooks called us the Lost Boys, you know. It was Deborah included. Because it was magical. It was sort of never land.
Did you know that you were going to marry Deborah when you first met her?
No. That's another story. Second year, I fished. A guy loaned us his 45-foot trimaran in Juneau, and we went to Yakutat. We went to the hot springs. We went up Glacier Bay. We climbed on glaciers. We did a little bit of fishing. You know, it wasn't much of a fishing boat, but. And we were partying in Glacier Bay one evening and all day, and then the evening, and the story is that we were anchored in Bartlett Cove, and I got back to the dock, and I decided I'd swim out to the boat, you know, and so I'm swimming along and realize that the current is running pretty good in the wrong direction, you know, and meanwhile, here comes Deborah and a couple other people in the raft rowing by, and they said, "You want a lift?" And I said, "Yeah, that'd be good." So we got back out to the Sitara, and there were a bunch of us staying on the boat. And we're sort of getting ready to go to bed, and I asked one of the women there, "Hey, you want to sleep with me?" And because it was those days, and she said, "No, I'm sleeping with Patrick." And Deborah said, "Well, I'll sleep with you," you know, and that was that. So, that's a story.
And then, once the kids came along, did that change anything for you?
Of course. Yeah, that's a massive life change, you know. Although most people figure you got kids, you're done with your life, you know, your life of adventure. But we obviously did just the opposite, and we started having wilder adventures, you know, more in the winters, you know. Tyga took his first steps at Machu Picchu when he was 9 months old. We drug them all over the planet, you know, so the life of adventure didn't end, but the life of responsibility increased, you know.
What? Why did your family decide to travel every winter?
Well, we lived in Fairbanks, actually, mm-hmm. in the winters. So we were at the Hobbit Hole in the summers, Fairbanks in the winters, and 60 below in the dark, it kind of grows on you, or kind of grows against you, I guess. So once the kids started going to school, they would go to school for the first semester, and then after Christmas, we'd take off and travel for the second half. So we'd get out of Fairbanks for the 60 below, you know, but we'd go 2 to 3 months and go wherever, you know. We traveled everywhere. It was great.
Do you have any places that you traveled that you really liked?
I liked everywhere we traveled, but we traveled most often in Nepal, which was always wonderful. Mm. And Namibia really stands out. Borneo really stands out. I don't know. Yeah, it is. Pretty amazing planet out there. I mean, the Hobbit Hole is one thing.
Yeah.
The planet's a pretty big oyster, too.
Are you still traveling now?
Yep. Not like we were, but yeah, we went to Mongolia a few years ago. This last year, we went and visited Taiga and Amy and the kids in Indonesia, and, you know. And so, yeah, and Rylan and Taiga are both travelers, you know. They're One's a surfer and one's a pro snowboarder, so they're traveling all over the world too.
When you decide to stay here, did you still keep in contact with your family back in Indiana?
Sure, you know, but it was before the days of internet and telephone. We had a marine operator you had to deal with, you know. So there was some letter writing, but I wasn't the best son and the best at corresponding. But yeah, I stayed in touch. I didn't go. By that time, my folks had moved to Michigan, you know. I had no interest in going back to Indiana, but we would go visit them in Michigan periodically.
Do you think they understood why you wanted to stay?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, my dad and I, we didn't get along all that well politically and all that. So, but when I bought a fishing boat, he'd been in the Navy, and the only time he ever wrote me a letter, he just said, "You're a good son," you know. It was pretty cool. So interesting facet there was when he died, one of his friends put together all his movies that he'd made, home movies. And in that group of movies, there was footage from England. It was Queen Elizabeth's coronation, and whenever that was, 1953. And my grandparents had gone back over for the coronation, and they were both from the very north of Scotland, John of Groats and Wick. And there was footage of Wick, Scotland, on the coast, of them unloading halibut boats, you know, in 1953. And I saw that and I went, oh my God, this is my heritage, you know. But, you know, it was just happenstance that I'd fallen into it. You know? But, yeah, I was like, that was eye-opening.
Do you know what brought your grandparents over here?
Well, it was after World War I, and I'm sure times were hard, and they were looking for employment, you know. And my grandfather was a painter, and he ended up in Indiana for some godforsaken reason. And he ended up starting painting, but then he built a casket factory. And they were metal caskets that needed to be painted, you know. So that's what he did, and that's what my dad did too, actually ran that casket factory.
And then, so you're also still fishing now, right?
Not very much. I think I commercially fished 10 days last year, you know, and so far I've got 5 in this year. But, so yeah, I don't take it very serious anymore. I still have a boat, and that's, And Deborah still has a boat, and my kids have boats, so I still have plenty to do.
Yeah. So what are some of the things that you do now?
The main things I do now, work on boats, that's one thing. But same thing, adventure, we just went out to Hot Springs for 4 days, and, you know, you've got plenty of kayaks here. We do what we want.
I want to let you get to your pancakes, but if there's, we can continue as you eat too. If there's anything else you wanted to talk about.
No, probably not. Anything I missed, Deborah?
Well, you and Dennis, the way you, the competition, I think was interesting. You and Greg were the best. You won the awards. What? Oh. 9 out of 10 years you won the award for.
No.
You and Greg did.
Greg won the award, yeah.
Yeah, and he was a little aggravated when you won it for 3 years.
Oh.
Yeah, Phil's just the only other one who...
Yeah, we used to sail to Excursion Inlet, and every year they would have a Highliner award. And Greg was like a machine. He just, first one up in the morning, first one out. Yeah, I just remember that first year I finally beat him for the season, you know.
How was the award decided?
It was basically who made the most money or sold the most fish to Excursion Inlet.
Oh.
And every year they would have a plaque down in Seattle on the wall. And they would give a prize, you know, Greg got a beautiful barometer. When I won it, they gave us airline tickets to wherever we wanted to go. You know, it was pretty cool.
So cool. Do you remember where you decided to go with that ticket?
No, I don't remember. Somewhere.
And this is just an award, like, for the Hobbit Hole, or?
No, it was just the Fleet. Everybody that sold to Excursion Inlet.
And was it sort of like back and forth between you and Greg?
Yeah, Greg actually won it 5 times. I just won it twice, something like that. But
did you feel there was like this sense of competition between?
Oh yeah, we were all
everyone there.
Between Deborah and I, between Dennis and all of us and Greg, and so yeah, there was a strong sense of competition fishing for sure. But then, you know, the Hobbit Hole, and we all, it seemed like every year Greg would have a big project, you know, so we'd always band together and work just like it's going on right now, you know. We put in that hydro project in the 80s, and Dennis and I hauled all that pipe up the hill, and, you know.
You didn't just haul it, you raced it.
Yeah. Well,
Snoozy and I would trudge with one pipe, and these guys would each have at least one pipe, and they'd run up the mountain. It was pretty fun. That was a little competitive, too.
And so you said you both lived there for 18 years?
More or less. Mm. I can't remember when the Hobbit Hole went private. When Jane got sick of us all.
Were people sort of upset when that happened, or they feel it was pretty natural?
No, we understood. Yeah. But it was definitely the end of an era. And at that time, we just lived on our boats, you know, we didn't have this house.
No. Why'd you decide to stay in Elfin?
What's that?
Why'd you decide to stay in Elfin?
Why'd we stay in Elfin? We fished out of here, you know. You know, when we were fishing back then, the ocean was very different. You know, we made our living in Cross Sound, you know, and now there are very few fish here. You know, the birds are dying off, the fish are different patterns, you know, the melting of the glaciers, the global warming is having an incredibly harmful, I'd say harmful effect on this area.
And you've noticed that just in
recent
decades?
Yeah, I've noticed it. Noticed it in Fairbanks, noticed it here. Vast changes.
But I heard you've had a couple of good years as far as fishing. Someone was saying last year was a good season.
Last year was a good season?
Last
year wasn't very good, and this year is even worse.
Oh.
So, but the difference is when we fished, we called the ocean outside of Cross Sound the Big O. And like I say, we made our living mostly in Cross Sound, and you can't do that anymore.
At North Island and Three Hill.
Yeah, right by the Hobbit Hole. So that's what made the Hobbit Hole beautiful, was we just get up in the morning, we were right on the fishing grounds, you know. Now, Tiger and Rye are out on the ocean. They're never here, you know, because that's where the fish are. The Cross Sound is melting glaciers and cold water, and the ocean out there is warming, and the salmon like the warmer water. I mean, eventually they run back to their natal stream, but until they have to make that final run, they're just hanging out there, you know.
And with the how dry this summer is, last summer too, the creeks aren't filling up, so the fish can't go up, and I think that's why the fish haven't come in. But also, another reason why
there are
no humpies in the creeks, because they can't go up, so I think they're just waiting.
Does that make you worried about, I guess, the future of fishing and, you know, Ronin generation, if they decide to...
Yeah, I was... I mean, when we got into fishing, everybody talked about this trolling, you know, what we do. It's a dying fishery, you know, it's on its last legs, and it's been on its last legs for 40 years now. Something keeps saving us, you know. But
hard work.
But the conditions right now are dire. It's, you know, and I mentioned the birds. You know, Cross Sound was just alive with birds, you know, and there's been massive die-offs of the murres, but a lot of the other birds too. You know, you don't see the puffins we used to see. You know,
you see puffins.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, there are always
puffins around.
You see a puffin or two puffins now. It's remarkable. You know.
Even seagulls during the King opening, I didn't have seagulls following me until you got in. Much closer. But that's kind of crazy. I didn't have sea lions chasing me.
Wow.
That's a first. So.
Is it like this all around Alaska?
Yeah, the dog runs. They close Neats Bay, which is the big dog trollery. The cost recovery in Juneau for dogs is supposed to get 10 million fish. They haven't even gotten a million, and they've been working hard for a month.
And everybody's hoping it's a late run, and we'll see. But.
And the humpies are coming in. So it might be a late run because of there's no water in the creeks.
What do you think people should do about it, if there's anything that can be done?
Start being aware, you know. I mean, people don't believe in global warming. Half the people in this community don't believe that there's global warming.
Really?
Of course, most. Oh, yeah.
And how do they explain the changes then?
I don't know. It's chance. But there's also a huge financial interest here in not believing in global warming. Or that, you know, the overfishing is hurting the fish stocks. You know, they argue against all that stuff. And, you know, we're predators. We catch a lot of fish and have forever. But we used to have a stronger fish and game to regulate us. Now fish and game is kind of owned by the big money, which is really sad, but it is.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that, I mean, the Hobbit Hole is now an ecological field school, right? It's teaching kids, or has, its goal is to, you know, educate people about global warming, climate change.
Yeah, I think we'll see. There's a lot of pipe dreams over there. They're pretty wide-eyed, but yeah, it's cool. And Coulter is making the place happen, you know. He is really impressive.
What was your reaction when you heard that Zach was thinking of turning the Hobbit Hole into a school?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Greg, at one point early on, when he said, eventually I'm going to pass this on, you know, he was talking about even giving it to Tahuna, to the natives, you know. But that didn't happen, and they tried to sell it for 7-8 years, you know. Crazy that nobody bought it. But and then the negotiations for actually selling it got a little mired, but it happened, and hopefully it's a good thing. We'll see.
Are there any concerns that you have about the school, or things that you'd like to see?
What's that?
Are there any things you'd like to see from the Institute, or any concerns you have about it right now?
Well, the one concern is it's too little too late, you know. It's as far as being an institute and studying this area, they've sort of missed the change, you know. But it's still happening, so we'll see.
And, you know, they're young people, and that's
right.
Who's got to take it over.
And there's enthusiasm, which is the most important thing, you know.
Well, we can end here unless there's anything else you wanted to add.
What's that?
We can end here unless there's anything else you wanted to add.
Well, the Hobbit Hole is a pretty special place, you know, and always has been. It was a seining site back when they seined, and then Doug and Flo Freed had it for a number of years till Doug died up in Lituya Bay, and that was, they call it the pothole then. And they're the ones that started the gardens, and, you know. And then we came in, and Ronald was the one who really kept those gardens and got them up and going.
Yeah, the only garden when we got there was the back garden by the swing in Spring Cove. There were none of the front gardens were there. So Ronald, I mean, was incredible. No.
Is this Ron Creer?
Yeah.
Mm. There was a tiny little dock with a haul out that you pulled the boat in, and our skiff was called Green Death because it was a aluminum skiff that wasn't safe to go around the Hobbit Hole in, but we'd travel back and forth to Elfin Cove, wind, rain, and darkness.
Greg and Reba coming back at 2 a.m. in a bloody gale, dragging stuff in through the water in Green Death. It was... Oh my gosh. And Regina had asked how, you know, we worked really hard. How did we find time to, you know, do the parties and the projects? How did we find time?
We didn't sleep.
Yeah, we were young. Sleep when you're dead. I knew there was an answer.
Yeah.
I think part of it is we must have fished the tides. You know, if we had a project to do, we'd fish the tide.
Early. We did projects during closures and after the season. And in the spring, you know, we'd get here. Although, back in those days, when we first got there, you could halibut fish 365 days a year, and I bought my first hand troll permit for $20, you know, it was a different era. It was easier to get into.
You think it's harder to be a fisherman now?
Definitely, yeah, for a young person to get in is... I mean, you got to have backing of some kind, you know. Boats are more expensive.
And you can't fish a skiff out there on the day.
Yeah, fuel's more expensive. Everything's more expensive, except the price that we get for fish hasn't gone up that much, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's...
Yeah, this is the same coho price that we had in
right,
the 80s.
Yeah. So
pretty crazy.
So it doesn't compute, you know. But the hatcheries... love them or leave them, they are producing more fish, you know. So the the numbers of cohos, for example, that our boys catch sometimes are just off the charts, you know, compared to what we caught, you know. So, and out of the hobbit hole, we were the humpy fleet, you know, so we caught massive amounts of humpies along with all the other species too.
And the humpies were small then.
Well, it varied from season to season.
But mostly they were way smaller than they are now. Not these 5-6 pound humpies.
Why are they bigger now?
Humpies and dogs are getting bigger. Hmm. It's just for whatever reason. Yeah.
That's kind of crazy that the price of fish hasn't gone up.
Yeah. King salmon price has gone up. Halibut prices and
halibut
black
prices,
prices have gone way up. But yeah, Bobo said $20 for his first permit. Now to buy a power troll permit is what, 37 or something?
Yeah, that varies too. But
that varies, but it's... Mm-hmm.
But yeah, for a kid to get into it, trolling's still the cheapest permit, but... You're talking tens of thousands of dollars instead of, you know, 50.
Wow.
Yeah. And like I told you, you know, my first boat, I borrowed a skiff and put an outboard on it, you know. You're not going to go out. Well, Dennis Montgomery would have, but besides him, you know, you're not going to go out to Deer Harbor in that
right.
And live, you know. It's a different world.
Yeah. Yeah, Dennis fished in a Boston Whaler for a long time.
And the first year he had a girlfriend with him, and we never saw her. She was always under the tarp making grilled cheese sandwiches for him. All day long. And he was a great fisherman.
Is he still fishing?
It's hard sort of to say.
He's kind of gone back to his roots. He has a little lund that he goes out and trolls with, you know. But no, he runs his outfitting business there.
In Gull Cove.
So who are the people you think I should talk to next?
Well, Dennis for sure. And Peggy for sure.
And then I'm planning on talking to Ron.
Yeah, definitely Ronald. He was the heart and soul of the Hobbit Hole. I don't know who else is around.
Hap.
Oh, Hap, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hap was a friend of Fred's, and he was trolling around and showed up at the Hobbit Hole and was there for a number of years until this place came up.
And he's a fish biologist, so he can remember what day he caught his biggest king salmon on what lure and at what time.
Wow.
So one of the things that's interesting, you know, this is so far before cell phones or any kind of communication, that we lived by the radio. In fact, the first newsletter we started when the fishermen made our cooperative here was called Channel 14, because that's the channel that we all stood by on. And they had radio shows going all day long, you know. It was just continual communication. I'd always have things go wrong on my boat. And, you know, everybody would answer. One day I got jellyfish in my eye. And, you know, I said, what do I do? And somebody would come back and say milk, and somebody else would say piss. You've got a piss in it. I've got a piss in my eye. You know? But, you know, all these, you know, people were, you know, always there to help. One time I was going through Middle Pass and there was this terrible ping sound. I got on the radio and said, my boat went ping. And that became, I don't know, that one got a lot of attention from everyone.
And the engine stopped.
Yeah, and my stabilizer had actually gone under and hit the prop. But that one everybody was pretty excited about. What would cause it to ping?
But yeah, our early days of fishing, we didn't have VHF. We had a CB radio and no radar. Fathometers were just, they were accurate, but they were just a dot, you know. So,
yeah.
So this is an advantage that people have now, you know, with all the GPS and the electronics and fish finders.
Much better equipment.
We fished North Island with no radar when heavy fog, because you could hear the pounding against the cliffs, and you knew where certain birds hung out, and you know it was.
And you could get behind Fred.
I guess in closing, I'd say the reason we do it is for the adventure, and then we make money at that adventure, and then we can go have other adventures. So it's worked out well for us.
You got to say something about the code wheel.
Oh, yeah. So in the old days, you know, like I say, by this time we had VHF radio. And, you know, we all communicated on Channel 14.
But everybody else was listening.
There were no cell phones. There were, you know. So we devised this code wheel. And it was a wheel inside a wheel that spun. And there were expressions. So if you were fishing at Soapstone at 20 fathoms.
With a green hoochie.
With a green hoochie, you'd get to that and you'd say, green split pea soup, or shiver me timbers, or, you know, there were all these sayings, you know.
And it was, I think Ronald devised the
code. Yeah, Ronald, you can't put it together, but.
That was Fred's idea.
It was, it worked really well, you know. So everybody had all kinds of codes and. But the code wheel was, I don't know, is there still one over there?
I don't know.
Somebody's got to have one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I should ask Greg or Fred if they have the code wheel at all anymore, or Dennis, I don't know.
Yeah.
I live by the code wheel.
Yeah. Can I tell the
Harv story?
Yeah, the Harv story.
Yeah.
So, you know, there were lots of codes, and at one point we were doing a square root code, So if you had 16 fish, you'd say, I got 4 this morning. Ugh, terrible day. And so at any rate, I was out fishing at Three Hill, and Dick and Paula came by, and I was catching them. And I think I talked to him and said, you know, I've only been out for a couple hours and I have 6 fish, which was good, you know. And then Harv came out and he said, I ain't gonna stop for 6 fucking fish, you know. And Dick said,
the code.
It's the code. It's the code. I don't know no fucking code. I'm not gonna stop for 6 fucking fish. And so Dick ended up explaining how to do a square root.
And Harv said, I don't know no fucking square root.
So we had to drop that code. But we're a secretive lot. That sounds like the boy.
Oh, Ronan.
Well, thank you so much, Bobo.
You bet.
Bye.